I've asked for some help today. I didn't give her or them much notice, but you going to help me? You can come up here and read. That's how we're going to start the sermon with these. Going to have Leah read. I'll talk about it after she reads. You get up here, or
which one should I read? Which one should I read?
Can you read the first one first? Just read.
Okay.
We'll read one and talk about it.
The Hare and the Tortoise. A hare one day ridiculed the short feet and slow pace of the tortoise, who replied laughing, "Though you be swift as the wind, I will beat you in a race." The hare believed her assertion to be simple and possible, assented to the proposal, and they agreed that the fox should choose the course and fix the goal. On the day appointed for the race, the two started together. The tortoise never for a moment stopped, but went on with a slow but steady pace straight to the end of the course. The hare, lying down by the wayside, fell fast asleep. At last, walking up and moving as fast as he could, he saw the tortoise had reached the goal and was comfortably dozing after her fatigue. Slow but steady wins the race.
Okay, you read the moral. So we've got a story. You should go ahead and stay up here if you don't mind. We've got a story, and she read the moral. So we know that's one familiar with, right? The moral of the story is it says slow and steady. You know, stick with it, and you win. So what do we learn from that story? Do we learn that foxes make good umpires? Or do we learn maybe that hares take naps on their way to doing whatever they want to do? Do we learn that? No, we don't learn that. We know that story, and we understand that it's making a point and that the details in the story are not necessarily making a point. What's the second one there? Don't read the moral, but just go ahead, and if you don't mind reading the second one.
The goose.
Is your brother going to read any, or are you going to read them?
He doesn't want to.
He don't want to, okay.
The goose with the golden eggs. One day, a countryman going to the nest of his goose found there an egg all yellow and glittering. When he took it up, it was as heavy as lead, and he was going to throw it away because he thought a trick had been played upon him. But he took it home on second thoughts and soon found to his delight that it was an egg of pure gold. Every morning the same thing occurred, and he soon became rich by selling his eggs. As he grew rich, he grew greedy, and thinking to get at once all the gold the goose could give, he killed it and opened it only to find nothing.
So what do we learn from that story? What's the moral of that one, or that one's about? Don't kill the goose that lays golden eggs. And the theme or the point of the parable or the topic of the parable was what?
Greed.
And we all understand that. We understand that it's not a story to teach us about the anatomy of birds. Right. We realize that. And, of course, these are stories we're familiar with. I think the third one, go ahead. Let's read the third one, too. You might know this one, you might not, but it's not as familiar.
The Ant and the Grasshopper. In a field one summer's day, a grasshopper was hopping about, chirping and singing to its heart's content. An ant passed by, bearing along with great toil an ear of corn he was taking to the nest. "Why not come and chat with me," said the grasshopper, "instead of toiling and moiling in that way?" "I am helping to lay up food for the winter," said the ant, "and recommend you to do the same." "Why bother about winter?" said the grasshopper. "We have got plenty of food at present." But the ant went on its way and continued its toil. When the winter came, the grasshopper had no food and found itself dying of hunger. While it saw the ants distributing every day corn and grain from the stores they had collected in the summer. Then the grasshopper knew.
You can read the moral there if you want.
It is best to prepare for the days of necessity.
Necessity, yeah.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Maybe you're not as familiar with that story, but it's the purpose of that story, when we read that fable, is the purpose to understand the wintering habits of grasshoppers. Does anybody know what the wintering habits of grasshoppers are? They're dead. The eggs live over the winter. So the story isn't accurate at all, but it doesn't matter. Why doesn't it matter? Leah, why doesn't it matter if grasshoppers live over the winter or not? Because it's best to prepare. The story is about being prepared, not to teach us about grasshoppers or ants, or that they can talk to each other as they walk past each other. That's not the point of it. These stories are 2,000-3,000 years old. They're attributed to Aesop, who was supposed to have lived somewhere between 600 and 550 B.C., and nobody knows whether he had these are his stories or not. There's lots of stories that have been added. There's probably hundreds now that come under this category, and who knows how many of them are his and how many of them aren't. We really don't know. It doesn't matter. But the point of these fables is to make a point. The point isn't to teach us about the details of grasshoppers or, you know, bird anatomy or anything like that. That's not what they're for. And they're fables. And why bring that up? Why talk about fables? Well, in your Bible are stories. They're called parables. They're stories that Jesus made up. They don't call them fables, we call them parables. But they're similar. We've looked at some in the past. I enjoy going through the parables. I enjoy reading about them from commentators and learning about the genre. I gotta put this up, sorry. Put this up where it belongs. And I'd like to look at one today called Lazarus and the Rich Man. It's in Luke 16. We'll spend the whole time in Luke 16. I'll refer to maybe two other verses as we go through. The question I have to start with is, what is the parable telling us? What is the story telling us? What is Jesus' purpose in giving that story? And that's what we're going to, I want you to think about that the whole time we're talking about it. We're going to talk about it for the whole sermon. But what's the purpose? Is the purpose to teach us that some geese lay eggs made of gold? Or that animals talk to each other, or the grasshoppers live all winter? Is that the purpose? Now, obviously, the reason I'm asking that question, and I referred to it a few weeks ago when I was talking about heaven and hell and the second resurrection and so forth, that this parable is used by some as just absolute proof that Jesus believed in an ever-burning hell where you're tortured forever, because he referred to it. And I don't believe that. I don't believe that. But it's there. It's there. There's a fire in the story. So how do we look at it? And I think once we spend a whole sermon, you already probably have an idea, of course, but once we spend a whole sermon looking at it and seeing what's there, we'll understand what parts of the story are golden eggs and what parts of the story are the morals that we're supposed to remember and go home with. What does this parable teach us about heaven and hell, if anything? So let's start in Luke chapter 16 and verse 19. Just going to read it. In fact, somebody in the congregation want to read it? From Luke 16, verse 19, all the way to the end of the chapter. Just want to read it without comment first. If somebody in the mood to read? You already had to read. Okay, you're already warmed up. Okay, good. Tell us what version are you in? Okay, thanks.
There was a certain rich man who was clothed in purple and fine linen and fared sumptuously every day. But there was a certain beggar named Lazarus, full of sores, who was laid at his gate, desiring to be fed with the crumbs which fell from the rich man's table. Moreover, the dogs came and licked his sores. So it was that the beggar died and was carried by the angels to Abraham's bosom. The the rich man also died and was buried. And being in torments and Hades, he lifted up his eyes and saw Abraham afar off and Lazarus in his bosom. Then he cried and said, Father Abraham, have mercy on me and send Lazarus that he may dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am tormented in this flame. But Abraham said, Son, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things, and likewise Lazarus evil things, but now he is comforted and you are tormented. And besides all this, between us and you there is a great gulf fixed, so that those who want to pass from here to you cannot, nor can those from there pass to us. Then he said, I beg you therefore, Father, that you would send him to my father's house, for I have five brothers, that he may testify to them, lest they come to this place in torment. Abraham said to him, they have Moses and the prophets, let them hear them. And he said, no, Father Abraham, but if one goes to them from the dead, they will repent. But he said to him, if they do not hear Moses and the prophets, neither will they be persuaded, though one rise from the dead.
Thank you. Going to back up a little bit. Now you've got the whole parable there. We'll spend more time on the setup than we will on the end of it. But before we even consider the actual parable, I'd like to turn back in the book of Luke a little bit and notice some things. Now, I didn't put this down. Where did I put this? I don't know where I put it. Well, I'll come to that later. Let's go back to Luke 12, or you don't have to necessarily go back. I'm just going to review the context. You know, it's called the travel narrative, where Jesus is presented as having read or given these parables on a trip as he was going from either Jerusalem to Galilee or vice versa. I forget which direction he was going. And in chapter 12, in verse 16, he spoke a parable to them, saying, the ground of a certain rich man brought forth plentifully. So we're talking about a rich man and his ground. Verse 21 says, and it said, the point of this parable is, so is he that lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. So then he says, there's a point to that. He gives a moral, if you want to call it that. He said to his disciples, therefore I say to you, take no thought for your life what you shall eat, neither for the body what you put on, for life is more than meat, and body more than raiment, and so forth. So you don't have to worry about this because God will take care of you. It says in verse 30, all these things the world seeks after, but the Father knows you need this. So seek the kingdom of God first, and all these things will be added. Sell what you have and give alms. Provide yourselves bags which wax not old, a treasure in the heavens that fails not, where no thief approaches, neither moth corrupts. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. So there's a main point there. You know, give alms, you know, be kind to others. And Luke, for what it's worth, if you read through the book of Luke and read through the book of Acts, he's always coming back to some kind of a topic or a situation or event that happened in Jesus' life or in Paul's life. He comes back to some, or in the early church before Paul, he comes back to these stories that have to do with money and how it was used. You know, if you ever noticed that, I haven't, you know, I had to read about it, and then I go, oh, yeah, that's true. You got Ananias and Sapphira. You know, Luke spends a lot of print there, a lot of paper in the beginning of the book of Acts explaining the story where they lied about what happened with the money. Simon tries to buy, as we talked about last week, I think it was, you know, Simon tries to buy the power to transfer the Holy Spirit to people. There's a money issue. Remember in Acts 15 when they had the conference about how the Gentiles will be part of the church? They said, they reminded them. They said, but be careful to keep in mind the poor. I forget how it was worded, but you know, take care of the poor in your journeys. Don't forget them. And Luke writes, you know, we were of a mind to do that anyway. That was already on our mind. And it was obviously on Luke's mind because Luke is always talking about money and he's always talking about taking care of the poor or poor that are not taken care of. That's a subject that he seems to, for whatever his reasons are, be interested in. So when he lists certain of Jesus' parables and includes them in his gospel, a lot of them have to do with money. A lot of them have to do with poor people and so forth. If we move on to Luke chapter 14, verse 7, he put forth a parable to those which were bidden and marked how they chose out the chief room, saying to them, when you are bidden of any man to a wedding, sit down not in the highest room, lest a more honorable man. So this has to do with honor, but basically honor had to do in that society with wealth. If you were well off, you were perceived to be more blessed by God, and you got the honorable seats and so forth. That was the system that they lived in. Isn't too much different from our system, is it? Then they had the party of the Sadducees that were well off and connected with the temple and were rich, and that's just the way it was. And they were the ones who were honored in society in general, if not universal. Verse 12. When you make a dinner or supper, don't call your friends or your brothers, neither your kinsmen nor your rich neighbors, lest they also bid you again and recompense be made you. So here Luke is bringing out this detail that Jesus brought out. And it's like, well, don't just invite people that can invite you back. It's a monetary issue here, right? It's a riches or rich and poor issue. Luke focuses on these things throughout his gospel. When you call a feast, make a feast, call the poor, the maimed, the lame, and the blind, and you would be blessed because they can't recompense you. They can't pay you back. This is on Jesus' mind, and it's on Luke's mind. Verse 16, a certain man made a great supper, bade many, and the servant said, they wouldn't come. And he tells them, I'll just skip down, they wouldn't come, and he says, go out. In verse 21, into the streets and lanes of the city, and bring here the poor and the maimed and the halt and the blind. You know, that God cares for these people. I was going to say also, but maybe even more so. He takes it as his responsibility to care for them. Once I put the glasses on, then I can't see regular. Luke 15, verse 11. It's going to be better leave them on. Certain man had two sons. Oh, this is the. The prodigal son, you know, he wants all his money ahead of time. He wants all his money when his father's not ready to die. He wants his inheritance ahead of time. Again, the subject is money. You get into chapter 16, and there says there's a certain rich man and the steward, and we went through that in another sermon, that had wasted his goods. So here's the topic again, and then we get to, verse 9, and he says, here's the points he starts making, and we talked about this a little bit when we talked about the unjust steward. Make yourselves friends of the mammon of unrighteousness, that when you fail, they may receive you into everlasting habitations. He that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much. And then verse 11 says, if you haven't been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to your trust the true riches? Now, what is unrighteous mammon in general? I mean, we say money. It's the things that we need to survive in this life. What then are the true riches? See, the unrighteous mammon you can't take with you. And Jesus makes that point. Luke makes, puts an exclamation point on it. You can't take the riches with you. You can't take it with you. What is it that's the true riches then, the true wealth that you can take with you? Okay. What you've done, your character, the spiritual knowledge you have, these are things that can stay with you. And Jesus' point in this parable is that you're not going to get the things you can take with you if you don't learn how to manage well the things that you can't take with you. And, of course, we focus on the things that we can't take with us. We need money to buy food, and so we worry about those things. And Jesus repeatedly says, you don't really need to worry about those things. I'll take care of you, or my Father will take care of you. You need to worry more about living a righteous life. Okay. Verse 14, I'm sorry. Talks about no man can serve two masters. And it says in verse 14, the Pharisees also who were covetous heard all these things and they derided him. And I can't speak Greek, but that word for derided is an interesting word. And I've got a couple of books here. This one I've used before, Jesus Through Middle Eastern Eyes by Kenneth Bailey. And he points out that word, and I looked it up just to double-check him, that word literally means turn your nose up. When it said derided him, it's just that little, stick your nose up, I'm better than you, kind of look to the side. It's a dismissive facial gesture. It doesn't have to do with any words. It's just, you don't count, you know. It's a sneer of sorts. Actually, I want to quote from Bailey here at this point. And by the way, I've got Bailey here, and I've got Klein Snodgrass, who I told you I had dinner with. I like him, but they don't agree. Sometimes I like, you know, you got to pick one or the other, or whatever. There's different ways of looking at certain things. I think we'll get some good points from both books, but they don't always agree. A few verses before, this is from Bailey. A few verses before the parable of Lazarus, there is a short poem on God and Mammon. The poem can be understood as an introduction to the parable. And Mammon is an Aramaic word, I didn't know that, an Aramaic word meaning material possessions or money. Now, remember Kenneth Bailey lived in the Middle East for a long time, and he probably learned, he seems to know Aramaic, so I guess he did. I just want to point out for what it's worth here that in this little poem, Jesus talked, and his disciples talked in Aramaic. And I can't speak Aramaic either, but here's the way the poem reads it, with some Aramaic words in it. This is extra bonus, don't worry about it. If you have not been faithful, amen, in the unrighteous mammon, material, so you got amen and then mammon, the amuna, the truth, who will entrust to you the truth? And the word for entrust to you is jamin ithkun. Jamin. So you have amen, mammon, amuna, and jamin. So it's a little bit of a pun or play on words in the language that Jesus was speaking. And there's some of that in the Bible. We can't possibly know it when we read it in English. You can't even know it if you read it in Greek. But if you realize they were speaking in Aramaic, then some of these things come out, and it shows that there was a little bit of creativity in how things were said and how things were written. He says, if you have not been faithful in what is another's, what is your own, who will give to you? That's his translation. All possessions belong to God because he created matter. Indeed, the earth is the Lord and the fullness thereof. It's from the Psalms. The basic biblical principle is foreign to contemporary capitalist West. The car in the driveway, the house I live in, the pen in my pocket, the watch on my wrist, the computer I use to compose these reflections, all belong to God. I am merely a steward of them. If all possessions belong to God, is there anything that is really mine or ours? There is. The small part of God's truth that we manage to understand and struggle to live out is truly ours. And as Ray says, you know, the actions that we do toward others, that's a part of actually putting that truth into action. And we will take it with us. God looks to see if his people are faithful stewards of material possessions and then decides what he will reveal to them of the deep things of God. The potential transforming power of such a worldview is limitless. So I thought that was interesting. I had more marked here, but I'm not going to read it all. He does talk about this parable being the third of a trilogy, the three, the prodigal son, who wastes his father's possessions. Then you have the dishonest steward, right, that we talked about before, who wastes his master's possessions, and then you come to Lazarus and the rich man, where the rich man wastes his own possessions. There are three stories about wasting stuff, and the thing that changes is whose stuff is being wasted. Now, the parables make other points as well. Okay, before we get into the verse by verse, let's notice the structure a little bit. Because this will come back to us again later. In verse 19, I'm going back to Luke 16. The rich man, who was clothed in purple and so forth, as Tammy read, and he fared sumptuously every day. So he had all these banquets. He was doing well, and included banquets, and there's a point made of that. And then you have a beggar named Lazarus, who was at the opposite end of the economic spectrum. The beggar died, was carried into Abraham's bosom. The rich man died, and he was buried. And we'll talk more about these verses, but there's two different ways you can look at this. There's not a right and wrong. You have Lazarus here and here. So you could say A, B, B, A. Or you could say rich man and Lazarus. Now,
rich man Lazarus later.
That's two different ways you can organize it, but we'll come back to this. I don't want to discuss it now. It has to do with pain and banquets. That's the way it's set up, and there's a point for that. And then after that, I didn't put all the rest. There's a dialogue between Abraham and the rich man. And the rich man says something, Abraham says something, and it happens three times. Okay, one more thing to look at before we go through it verse by verse. And that is the genre, or the type of story that it is. It's a story, okay? Some people argue that it's literal. One reason they argue that it's literal is because Lazarus is named, and for what it's worth, that's the only character in a parable, any of Jesus' parable in the Gospels that's named, other than God or Abraham in this one. It's the only parable that's got people with names. So for what that's, and there's a reason for that. We'll talk about it when we get there. But it's not a true story. It's a story. It's just a story to make a point. And these kinds of stories are common in the Middle East. They're called reversal of fortune stories. And we have the same thing in our English tradition. We generally don't, I shouldn't say we have the same thing. They're not really the same thing. They're rags to riches stories or Horatio Alger stories where people go from rags to riches in this life. This is a typical, not just Middle Eastern, but really these stories are the world over, story where the end of the story doesn't happen in this life, it happens in the next life. And things are reversed. And that's exactly what happens here with Lazarus and the rich man. And that's the genre of the story. Just because that's the genre of the story does not mean that that's the main point of the story. That the only thing we need to learn here is that there's a reversal of roles. And let me just, if I can quote from Snodgrass here. Well, I'm not going to quote. I'm just going to summarize because he's got like three or four pages here where he talks about some background material to this parable. And he says, he talks about in early Jewish writings, for instance, beginning in wisdom and extending for several chapters in contrast, is a contrast between the judgment of the unrighteous and the righteous. The souls of the latter are in the hand of God. Point being, you have many writings that talk about the difference in how the righteous are going to be treated compared with the unrighteous. They're not all what we would believe doctrinally that this is really what's going to happen, and maybe they weren't intended when they were written. These are extra-biblical sources. But maybe it wasn't even intended to be taken literally. The point is that just because a certain situation exists between people in this life does not mean that that extends into the next life. And we would all agree with that. And this parable is an example of that. He goes through lots of them. First Enoch, Fourth Ezra, a lot of intertestamental writings. And there's no way, there's no point in summarizing them other than to say there's many, many stories that talk about that justice will be done and wrongs will be righted. Okay? And actually, in a way, this whole book, this is me talking now. This whole book is about wrongs being righted. That in the end, justice prevails. Not in this life. This life is not fair. And the Bible nowhere claims that this life is fair. Only that God's going to make it right in the end. And we think sometimes that means that God's going to exact all this vengeance, but the reality is, according to the prophets, God is very merciful, and maybe he won't. Maybe he will forgive, and that's a wonderful thing about him. He's different than we are as human beings. Okay, also, he's got some from Greco-Roman writings, some Egyptian stories, just many, many stories here that are reversal of roles stories. In fact, there's some people that seriously think that this particular parable may have come from one that was very popular in Egypt and it was repeated all over the Middle East. And I don't need to go into it, but it's a very similar story. And Snodgrass and others say, there's no reason to think that Jesus just took that particular story and changed it a little bit. It's a very common type of story, and I think most scholars believe he just made his own up the way he wanted to, rather than borrowing a particular one from the past. Okay. The rest of the sermon, we'll just spend some time on the verses, some more than others. This is where, I know you've been through this whole parable yourself in the past. I won't guarantee you, but I'll almost guarantee you that something that I've researched and found out will be something you might not have considered before. So there's certainly a bunch of things that I didn't think about in the same way that made this parable come alive to me. Verse 19, there was a certain rich man who was clothed in purple and fine linen and fared sumptuously every day. Okay, he's a rich man. He's not given a name. Although, does anybody know his name? This is a very popularly repeated parable throughout the history since it was given. And he's given a name in the repetitions of the parable. Anybody know what that is? Dives, Divas, something like that. I don't know why. But you might see that name. It's not biblical, but refers to him. It says that he was clothed in purple. What does that indicate? Anybody know? I know I've mentioned it before.
Royalty.
Can, but in this story, wealth. Why wealth?
Because it was costly to make a garment
purple, to dye. Right. The purple dye is costly because it came from a particular marine organism that was hard to get. Remember when I don't remember what I was talking about right now, but I mentioned Lydia, who was a dealer in purple. I was talking about women. In the New Testament, that she had to be pretty well off. She had a business where she was making this purple dye, and things that used the purple dye. So that showed she was no slouch in the community. All right, it says, but it doesn't just say he was clothed in purple. It says he was clothed in purple and fine linen. Anybody know what that is? Well, no, fine. It's linen would be linen. It would be similar to what we have today, like Egyptian. The word is basos or something like that. I looked it up, busos, which is from the Hebrew butz, which refers to a particular Egyptian cotton, which must have been good back then. It's still good. You want the best cotton in the world? It's Egyptian. I don't know why. Now it is. I found that out at that one hotel we stayed at in China that one time by mistake. The hotel we paid for was booked, and they put us in a really nice one. And it was the most comfortable bed I've ever been in my life. And we found out from the later on, we wrote them and said, what do you put in those beds? Like, what makes the bed so comfortable? And they kind of gave us a rundown of that, what the pillows were, what the sheets were, what all that stuff. And the sheets were some high thread count Egyptian stuff. And so it's still good. And that's what the word here means. So it's Egyptian linen, cotton fabric. But why would it even mention it? What is it? What's it talking about? The purple, you see. The linen, you don't. It's his underwear. It talks about his underwear. He's like, this guy's so rich, he's even got high-quality underwear. He goes to Victoria's Secret or whatever. He got the stuff that costs good money. Yeah. That's what it's talking about. It's talking about his undergarments. And it says he fared sumptuously every day, okay? Here you go. Rich man, he eats well every day. Every day. Now, there are some, Bailey, for instance, who says, if he ate well, if he fared sumptuously at a banquet every day, that means he didn't give his servants off for the Sabbath, so he was breaking the law. Maybe. I don't know that when you say he fared sumptuously every day, that Jesus is trying to make the point that that's literally true every day. It just meant the guy ate well. But perhaps it even means he was disobedient to the law by not giving his servants off on the Sabbath. The point is he ate very well, and that's in contrast to Lazarus, who did not eat very well. So we're drawing up this contrast, and that's the point of the early verses in this parable, is to make sure that we understand the difference between these two individuals and how it's going to flip in the end. Now, verse 20, it says there was a certain beggar named Lazarus. Again, that's significant because nowhere in any of Jesus' parables is a main character named like that. There are stories like Simon and the woman and all that, and he tells a parable during his trip there. But account of the dinner is literal and true, whereas he tells a story while he's there. In this case, there's a story and a guy gets a name. Anybody know what Lazarus means? It's from Eliezer, which means he who God helps. That's the derivation of it. So it kind of, and this goes with Snodgrass and what he says, it it kind of, in the very setup of the parable, is making the point that God's going to help one of them. It's going to be the beggar. You know, that God's more interested in helping the beggar than he is in helping the rich guy. So it kind of, it sets the stage a little bit right there. So he's named, let's make sure I don't forget anything from my notes here. Okay, and it says, he was laid at his gate, at the gate of the rich man, full of sores. So what's that mean if he was laid there? What do you deduce from that? Anything?
He's an invalid.
He couldn't get there on his own. So at least somebody was caring for him a little bit. Other poor people that weren't invalids in the community. Why would they take him to the gate of the rich man?
So he could beg.
Why would you beg at the rich man's house? Well, that's obvious. Those are the people that have more. And the people that come and go through the gate to these fancy banquets, they're going to have more too. Maybe they got some loose change. Maybe they got some food. Maybe they got, you know, go over to my house. I got food over there. Well, you can't go. So I don't know how that would work. But, you know, if you want to get the most in alms, you're going to hang around the richest people if you can, or at least in the traffic where the rich people go. So they laid him at the gate. Says he was full of sores. So not only was he poor, but he wasn't well. And he was an invalid. Maybe it's kind of bed sores because he couldn't get up and move, you know? Just, you know how that goes. Doesn't spell it out, but Jesus is telling the story and he's painting a picture here. And the picture is you got this rich guy that is eating well and all these other rich people that are coming to and from his house, and they got to walk past this guy who's he's really poor. He looks terrible because he's got these sores. And, you know, it's showing the contrast. Okay, it's making it obvious. It's like a beggar out in front of the Waldorf Astoria or something like that. That's the point. It's a definite contrast, and it's painted that way on purpose by Jesus. So this guy was dependent on alms. He was dependent on help from other people. He didn't have anybody to take care of him other than at least some who were able and willing to carry him to somewhere else where he could get some help, maybe. This is one thing I'd never noticed before. Lay him at the gate. I never thought about that before. And some of it I thought through and came to me. Some of it I read in the books. But one thing that came to me is that if he has a gate, if the rich man has a gate, what does that tell you anything? And think back to some of the sermons that I've given with PowerPoints that show, for instance, with Jesus, Simon, and the woman. And I said, here's the way the houses were laid out in town. And, you know, individuals could just come in and out of the house and watch the goings on and kind of not get something to eat, but they could hang out, you know, on the walls or whatever, nearby. So that's the way your houses were. How about this guy's house? Could you wander in, wander out the courtyard? No, because he had a gate. It's kind of like we have gated communities. Well, he had a gate. So he's really rich. He's got enough money that his house doesn't have to be right on the street. Maybe it's even out of town. Who knows? But it's somewhere where there's a gate, so you can't even get to the house without going through the gate. And what's going to be at the gate? Guard, and maybe what else besides a guard? Dogs or dog. Yeah, it says there's dogs that lick his wounds. There's dogs around. Sometimes we think, oh, he's just a poor guy with all these sores and all the dogs from the community come out. That's not as likely of a answer or a way of looking at it as the dogs that were on the inside or nearby. The ones that would chase away people that are going to cause trouble, they got to know Lazarus because he was there and maybe even extended a little bit of kindness to him by licking his sores. Some people argue about that. Some people say it was a kindness. Other people say that it just shows how pathetic he was, that, you know, these dogs are adding to his misery. In the Greek, it says, we haven't gotten to that verse, it's in verse 21, but it says, in Greek, it's but the dogs licked his sores. So, not Snodgrass, and not other commentators, but Bailey in particular, says, it's saying but to draw a contrast and a distinction between these dogs and everybody else. In other words, the dogs showed some care and concern for him, even though their master wouldn't. Can't prove that one way or the other, but I think the "but" does indicate that it's not, you know, in King James it says, "moreover, they licked his sores." As in, on top of it all, you know, and I don't, you know, Bailey's saying, no, it doesn't mean that. It means, actually, the dogs had more mercy than the rich man and the other people that came to and from. So, take it either way. I like Bailey's look at it there.
The dog will heal itself by licking itself, and that's what they'll do.
That's a good... That's,
I had a dog that licked himself back together again from getting ripped apart.
Is there truth, and you know, you people that know more about this than I do, is there truth to that idea that in dogs, saliva is actually some kind of healing substance?
Mm-hmm.
Bailey says that in his book. I don't know. Say mother's spit can dissolve anything. I don't know about dog spit. But, or clean anything. Is that what it is? Yeah. Anyway, Bailey, he quotes some study or something saying that dog saliva actually has some kind of healing quality.
Well, I saw it for myself. I mean,
so, yeah, yeah.
The dog got ripped apart by two bigger dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And the veterinarian said there's nothing we could do, so he actually licked himself together with his own
mouth. And dogs were, in general... In the society in Jesus' time, they were looked down on. They called Gentiles dogs. They you know, it was unclean like a pig. So in general, you looked down at a dog. But Jesus, in his parable, seems, I think, is making the point that this animal that you all think nothing of and look down on, actually, this animal was the only person showing any care, or only person, only the only character in the story showing any care and concern. These dogs. So the ones that you, this happens so much in the Bible, so much, where there's a reversal of what you would expect. I gave a sermon on that where it happens in Exodus, right? Where what you would expect isn't what happens, the opposite. It's the same in the account of creation. But here, you know, the dog, the animal that you would look down on, is the one creature in the story that shows some care and concern. So again, the Bible is full of that. Jesus' parables are full of that. Where just what you think is the opposite of what happens. So I tend to agree with Bailey on this one. Oh, back to the gate. We just started talking about the gate. But one thing I hadn't thought about with the gate is that although we think a gate, the purpose of a gate obviously is to open and close and let access. In Lazarus' case, what did it do? Did it give him access to anything? Gate was, for all practical purposes, it was a fence. It didn't move for him. So, once again, Jesus is painting this very clear picture of a difference between Lazarus and the rich man. And to put an exclamation point there, we have a gate. And Lazarus isn't going through. And the rich man isn't coming out to see Lazarus either. If he is, he's going to go right by and ignore him. With his nose up in the air, like it talks about in verse 14. You know, he doesn't care. The only attention that's paid to Lazarus is by the guy's guard dogs. So we're really painting a stark picture here. There's a big difference between Lazarus' pain and the rich man's banquets. And there's a gate in between, and that gate doesn't allow a passage back and forth. And you'll see later why I'm making a big deal about that. So the guy had a big place, big estate. He's not right on the street. You got to go through a gate. Lazarus, obviously very needy, got these sores, and he just can't get around on his own. And it says in verse 21 that he desired to be fed with the crumbs which fell from the rich man's table. When Luke says desire something, in any other case, it's talking about desiring something you don't get. It's talking about an unfulfilled desire, an unfulfilled wish. So Lazarus wants these crumbs, but he doesn't get them. Who gets the crumbs? Dog gets the crumbs. The dog gets the crumbs. And one source, I never heard this one before. One source said that some of the bread that gets discarded is used to wipe your hands. So, you know, you're dipping this stuff, and it doesn't go into detail, but you're dipping stuff in the soup kind of thing, right, to get it out. And you get it on your hands. And sometimes, I guess, rather than licking your hands, maybe in good company, you just take a little piece of bread, and you wipe yourself off and just toss it down for the dog. I hadn't heard that one before.
They didn't have paper towels.
No, they didn't have paper towels. Now, so he's desiring to be fed. He has no way to be fed, no way to be taken care of. It's common to put people like that in a place that where there's a chance of some help. Even today in Asia, or in America, something, you know, if you have a kids you don't want, they'll put it on the church doorstep. In Asia, they'll put the pets that they don't want at the temple. They drop them off at the temple because the Buddhist monks will take care of all the dogs in town. In fact, they take care. I mean, they take some in, and the ones they don't take in, they feed. Because, and you can hear it's every morning. It's just rawr, 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 rawr. It's like Pied Piper. And all these dogs, when the bell rings at the temple, at the Wat, all these dogs leave town and go to the Wat because they're going to get fed and then they come back. It's just a, anyway, to put Lazarus near the gate of the rich man, that was a logical thing to do. Somewhere where there's people that could help, just like we might put somebody at a church or something like that, or drop somebody off. Okay. We got ahead of ourselves talking about dogs. I was going to bring that up. The state. Okay, lick the sores. Okay. So up to verse 21, we got the scene set. We've got a gate. It separates Lazarus from the rich man. And you couldn't make the contrast any more real than what Jesus has already done. It's very clear who's in what status. Okay. And then verse 22 says, "It came to pass that the beggar died and was carried by the angels into Abraham's bosom, and the rich man died and was buried." Okay, so now, in order to do a reversal of roles story, you have to die. So we have some deaths here, and now we're going to see what happens after death. And they die at roughly the same time. So that's the way the story is going to work. And it says, notice it says that the beggar died and was carried by the angels to Abraham's bosom, and it says the rich man died and was buried. What's the difference between the beggar who's died and angels have to carry him somewhere, and the rich man who's died and he's buried? Anybody have an idea there? I wouldn't have thought of this. I read it in a book. It doesn't say that the beggar was died, or Lazarus died and was buried. What's that tell us? Probably. That Jesus, in telling a story, he's drawing the picture he's drawing is that this guy doesn't get a burial. He doesn't get a funeral. He doesn't have anybody that cares for him. He's not going to get a decent burial. Whereas the rich guy gets a burial. Okay? It doesn't mention a funeral for the beggar. So we're adding a little bit to the difference between the two. What's it mean to go to Abraham's bosom? What's that indicate? What's that expression mean? Can you think of anybody that was in anybody's bosom in the Bible? In the book of John? And they all disciples wanted to know who was going to betray. Jesus said, "One of you is going to betray me." And word spreads around the table to ask John to find out. Why were they asking John? John was laying at Jesus' bosom. So, how did you have a typical meal, at least a banquet type meal, on a what? Brad knows what this is. Triclinium. Right? You sit around on these things. You don't sit. Sorry, you lay. You're reclining on this thing. And right here is the person of honor. And to his right is the person who's at his bosom. So in this picture, the beggar has been taken to Abraham's bosom. The image that Jesus is drawing, that everybody that hears the story understands in those days, is that you've got this banquet going on, you've got a triclinium, you've got Abraham right at the head, and to his right is Lazarus at the position of honor, right next to Abraham. Who's at the banquet now? Lazarus is at the banquet. That's the picture, okay? Here we get the reversal of roles. Lazarus is at the banquet. And it's interesting here that Jesus doesn't bother to explain why. Because nowhere does it say that Lazarus is a righteous poor guy, righteous beggar. We don't know anything about Lazarus. Not that he's a real person, but we don't know. So the only thing we can deduce, if we deduce anything from this, is that God is going to be predisposed to have mercy and care for the poor guy than he is the rich guy. That there's a, you know, God and the prophets are full of that, that God cares for those that are poor and needy. And he tells us to care. That's part of what we're supposed to do. But it's his job. He takes the responsibility of caring for the poor and needy. So that's part of the story here. The rich man gets a burial. But then he finds himself in verse 23 in hell, or in Hades, which is, as I covered a few weeks ago, that's just a generic term, in a sense, for the realm of the dead, and it has wide use. But that's where people go when they die, good or bad, that Hades is the place. Now we think of it as hell being the bad place in heaven, but back then, if you're dead, you went to Hades. That's kind of like a holding tank or whatever. You know, I don't know what the... There were all kinds of different theories and different ideas and philosophies that went with it, but it was the abode of the dead. And it says he lifts up his eyes, being in torment, and sees Abraham far off and Lazarus in his bosom. So he's wherever the dead people are, but he can see Lazarus at this banquet. And he sees Abraham there. Now, it doesn't explain what the torment is. But in the context of the story, and the context of the story is not, I don't think, teaching us a torment in the underworld any more than the context of the goose that laid the golden eggs is trying to teach us about the anatomy of birds. Because the main point here is something else. So what kind of a torment? Who was in torment in the beginning? Lazarus. Lazarus was in torment. Lazarus had no control over his destiny. People carried him where he went. He hoped that somebody would give him something. He had no say in his life. And he lived in torment. Not only that, he could only wait at the gate, and the rich people went back and forth and back and forth and ignored him. And that was his torment. Now, in a reversal of roles story, the one who is the favored one in the beginning of the story ends up being in the condition of the unfavored one that the unfavored one had at the beginning. So Lazarus is in torment at the beginning of the story. The rich man is in torment at the end of the story. And that's just the way the stories work. And it's not an indication of what Hades is like any more than grasshoppers talking to ants is an indication of how the real insect world works. Okay? That's the point of reading those fables at the beginning of the sermon. Is that if you want to focus on the wrong thing in the fable, you can come up with all kinds of goofy conclusions. And if you're going to look at the parable of Lazarus and the rich man as a story to tell us what the afterlife is like, you're missing the entire point of the story. So... Okay.
And it says when the rich man died and he was buried, so that is, and he was in hell or in the grave. So this is talking about it can be read, but at least this is what came to my mind. This is talking about they're both second resurrection.
Oh, that could be. If I don't think that, again, I don't think it was Jesus' purpose this is my personal opinion, and most that you read. I don't think it's his purpose to explain the afterlife, or even although he is alluding to a resurrection, I agree with that. I don't think he's trying to explain the nature of the resurrection. I think his main point is something else. But certainly there's resurrection being alluded to. And it's talked about explicitly in the conversation between Abraham and the rich man later, where it talks about coming back from the dead. Yeah. So that's torment. And I don't think it's literal. I think it's figurative in this sense, but we'll just go through to the end and see. Thank you. In verse 23, he lifts up his eyes, being in torment, and he sees Lazarus. So there's in these stories, there typically is a connection between the end of one individual and the end of another. In other words, they can see one another, contact one another, somehow or another. And that's necessary in the story to make the story work. Because there's no point in seeing this reversal of roles. Well, there could be. But to make the story complete, you see the reaction of the individuals who are involved in the story. And that's another part of the story of Lazarus and the rich man. Lazarus, you see nothing. He's not involved in a conversation. He's just there. But there's a lot he could say. But he thought, Jesus doesn't have him saying anything. He could say, you got what you deserve. But we don't have any of that. That's that the indication that Lazarus is a bigger man than that, apparently. But the rich man has a lot to say. We'll look at that here in a minute. I could read, and I won't. I'll just summarize. Snodgrass, and I'm not sure what his doctrinal leanings are one way or the other, but he makes the point, as a lot of scholars do, that we should not use this parable of Lazarus and the rich man to come to any conclusions on the afterlife. That's not the purpose of the parable, and that using it for that is using it for the wrong reason. The use of folkloric themes and the fact that this is a parable with intent other than teaching about the future life should warn against taking the picture too literally. And conformity with the rest of Luke's teaching in the New Testament on the future life would seem required for any conclusion. So even Snodgrass realizes that what you see here is not consistent with what we see in the rest of the Bible. So we shouldn't take it too far. And he talks about how Sheol in Hebrew and Hades is the realm of the dead and so forth. And I don't necessarily want to read through all that, but he just says we need to be very careful because Jesus is taking a popular motif here. And you notice in verse 24, he says more, "Father Abraham, have mercy on me," the rich man says, "and send Lazarus that he may dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am tormented in this flame." So it mentions a flame. Now, Jesus could be mentioning a flame in the story because it's consistent with the Gehenna fire that he says and other scriptures say that is the final, the end of an unrepentant sinner, is to burn up. So there's a fire, and then figuratively here, as he's burning up or before he burns up or whatever, he's figuratively having this conversation with Abraham. So again, it's figurative. It's not intended to be taken literally, but even Jesus involves a flame, which we would say that's associated with the lake of fire. In popular Jewish stories from the intertestamental period and of Jesus' time, there was starting to be a little bit of an idea that there was this flame where people were going to suffer. And it wouldn't surprise me if Jesus said, hey, just take a popular idea here to make a point. I don't think Jesus is agreeing with that point at all, because I don't think the scriptures bear it out. Yeah. That was it. But it's clear in the Bible that there is a time when people are going to burn up. There is a fire. So, Jesus in this parable, he didn't have to mention a fire, but apparently he did. So that's where people get, we're obviously talking about a hellfire and blah, blah, blah. And they already have an idea that comes from the Greek and Plato and everything. They got these this idea already, and they try to fit this into it. But I don't think it fits. I don't think it fits. Notice that the rich man wants one thing. What did Lazarus want when he was at the gate? What did he desire? He only desired one thing, according to the story.
Crumbs.
Now, the shoe's on the other foot. That's what happens in a role reversal story. The rich man wants one thing. What does he want? A little bit of water on his tongue. You know, that's not going to put the fire out, but he's tormented. What's interesting, and I wouldn't have thought of this either. It's more Bailey that brings it up. He says, you know, send Lazarus. So in this story, you got a rich man who has a chance, at least for the purpose of a literary story, right? He has a chance to be repentant, doesn't he? Oh, yeah, I messed up. That guy was outside my gate. I ignored him all along. I'm sorry. What can I do? We don't see that at all, do we? He says, Father Abraham. Well, why is he calling Father Abraham?
Because he's Jew.
He's Jewish, and Abraham's the patriarch. And now the rich man needs a favor. And who do you go to? You go to the old man of the family. You know, they have, in next culture, there's an obligation to help family, to help anybody, really, but especially family. Of course, you get through the whole story, I'll just mention it now. Abraham doesn't help him, does he? Which puts a lie to the theory. You know, the fact that Abraham is the patriarch, okay? And this Jewish man, this rich man, is not helped. What big lesson does that teach? There's a lot of lessons in this story. They're not all the main one. But what big lesson does that show us? That Paul goes through again and again and again. Well, true, but I mean, why? The fact that he wouldn't help in this story, he's not going to help this guy. You're not saved just because you're Jewish. Just because you're, you know, that was the idea. When Jesus was getting these discussions with the Pharisees or the Sadducees, they said, we have Abraham as our father. You know, that was their mindset. We are children of the covenant. God can't treat us badly, you know? We're already in. And this parable makes a point, no, you're not. No, you're not. And that was radical. That was a radical teaching. You're not saved by your race. But it's interesting that the rich man, when he has a chance, you know, Jesus could have worded this however he wanted to. But this guy, instead of repenting, instead of saying, boy, I'm sorry, I really blew it, he says, Abraham, you know, give me some help here. Send Lazarus. Like, he's been looking down at Lazarus his whole life, and now he's being tormented, and he's not at the bosom of Abraham, but he has some communication there, and he says, send Lazarus. Like, he's still looking down at Lazarus. That's amazing. You think he might, you know, something might come to him. And maybe that explains some of Abraham's responses in the story. You know, the guy still doesn't get it. He still doesn't get it. Notice what he says. He says, Father Abraham, have mercy on me. What does have mercy on me? What kind of an expression is that? In you can write it down if you want. Luke 18, verse 38. There was that beggar. And Jesus was walking. Somebody, he couldn't see. He was blind. And somebody told him Jesus was walking by. He said, have mercy on me. Now, that's what beggars said. Have mercy on me. So, again, it's a whole story about flipping. You know, the shoe's on the other foot, or, you know, flipping of fortunes, reversal of fortunes, whatever you want to call it. So the guy who was begging before and who said, have mercy on me, he's at the banquet now, and the one who was used to be at the banquet is now saying, have mercy on me. So there's all kinds of little hints in there. Also, he says, send Lazarus. What does that tell us? I didn't think about this either.
Equating Lazarus to a servant.
Well, that, but I mean, just the fact that He mentions him by name. He knew him. So he ignored him, but he did know he was there. And that's, I think that's a critical piece of information. That You know, we have a responsibility to care for those in need around us. Well, we don't always know of everything. But in this story, it's clear that the rich man knew who Lazarus was, because he says, send him. He's still looking down at him, as Jim says, but he's a known quantity, okay? So while they were alive, the rich man knew about this beggar and chose to ignore him. Oh, maybe. There could be all kinds of points.
One thing that struck me about this looking now on tour is that he's crying to Father Abraham, not Father God. Like he's equating Abraham to his God.
Maybe, but that's just the way the story's set up, but yeah. Yeah.
That he's asking Abraham all these things, not God. He's looking for a human being, really.
Well, and that's the way they Abraham was their hero, for sure.
Yeah. And the God, that's his God.
Yeah. So we have this torment, we have even a fire. The point is to show who gets honored in the end and who doesn't. That's the point of it, not to explain the afterlife. But Abraham says, son, no, he agrees that, you know, he doesn't argue the fact that I'm the patriarch and you are a son of mine. He says, son, remember that in your lifetime you received good things like Lazarus evil things, but now he is comforted and you are tormented. Okay, so it's just a role reversal. The pain is now rich man's, the comfort is now Lazarus, and that's the bottom line of the whole story. That's why Jesus worded it that way. It was a common genre, a common type of story at the time, and still is actually. And notice that it follows that same pattern, that we saw at the beginning. Verse 6:26 says, "Beside all this, between us and you, there is a great gulf fixed. They that want to pass from here to you cannot, neither can they pass to us that would come from there." He says, you know, you used to have that gate, and there's still a gate. You know, and I think, too, the lesson here is at some point it's too late to repent. You know, at some point there is that lake of fire. You had your chance. You know, I'm not saying that this is a detailed thing of saying which resurrection is which, and I don't think that's the point of it. But the lesson is there that at some point God says, okay, that's the way you are, that's the way you are. I'm not going to fight with you about it. eventually there's a gulf that's not going to be bridged. And that's scary. And then in verse 27 and 28, he wants him to warn his brothers. Abraham gives a very clear answer that, you know what, there's already enough information in the scripture. That's all they have is the Old Testament. There's already enough information there. They've already been warned. If they don't want to listen, that's their problem. In fact, they didn't listen, and they're not going to listen if we did something else. So, the Old Testament, as we have it today, has enough information there to let us know how to live, how to care for people like Lazarus, and the fact that we should care for people like Lazarus. And if we don't, we have only ourselves to blame for how we end up. And notice verse 31, and I think that verse has double meaning, just my personal feeling. It says, he said to him, if they don't hear Moses and the prophets, they won't be persuaded even though one rose from the dead. And, you know, we read somewhere else, I guess it's in the book of John, right, that somebody named Lazarus did rise from the dead, and it didn't persuade, at least the leaders didn't persuade them. In fact, it just made them want to kill Jesus all the more. So maybe that's another reason why he's named in this parable, that it just makes obvious a little bit of a connection between the real Lazarus and this guy in the story, that, you know, even though there is a resurrection, has been, right, that's not going to convince these people. They're beyond convincing for whatever reason. Also, it's kind of interesting that in the story, the guy, not only is he the rich guy not repentant, but he's arguing with Abraham. You know, Abraham tells him something. Oh, no. It's like, it's silly. So Jesus presents the rich guy as basically unreachable all the way through. He's not getting the point. He didn't get it when he was alive. He doesn't get it when he's dead. You know, the whole story is about a guy that this is, and it's a caricature. It's not meant to be, this is an actual real person. It's a caricature. It's the worst that somebody can be. They've ignored the poor. They had the ability to help, and they chose not to. And there's a penalty to be paid for that. And I was going to ask, so what's the point? And I just gave the answer. I think that's the point. I think it's the main point of the whole message, the whole parable. Lazarus not only had a beggar at his gate, but he was rich, and he could have helped. Even his dogs apparently helped, but he wasn't going to help. And Jesus says, or Abraham in the story says, we got all these books. We got the whole Torah. We got the prophets to talk about how to be fair and loving and caring for the widows and the orphans. It's all through the prophets. It's all there, and you ignored it. But you think because you're one of the, you know, child of Abraham, that you're going to receive honor in the next life. And this parable makes it very clear. No, you're going to have pain in the next life. At least that's the way the story is written. You know, your fortunes are going to be reversed. You and the poor. God cares for the poor. He tells him, Father Abraham, in verse 25, says, Son, remember. Okay, that's one thing the prophet said again and again and again. Remember. You know, he encourages him to listen and to act. It's too late to act. He doesn't have that approach and that attitude anyway. So I don't think it's a parable about hell or heaven any more than Aesop's fables were trying to teach us about bird anatomy or anything else like that. The point is that just as Cain seemed to misunderstand when he killed Abel, I think the main point of the parable is that, yes, we are our brother's keeper.